Have we entered what Earth scientists call a termination event? And what can we do to avoid the worst outcomes? How can a spiritual connection to nature guide us toward better environmental stewardship? What can ancient wisdom teach us about living harmoniously with the Earth? How have wetlands become both crucial carbon sinks and colossal methane emitters in a warming world? Ewan Nisbet is an Emeritus Professor of Earth Sciences at the Royal Holloway University of London. Specializing in methane and its impact on climate change, his research spans Arctic and tropical atmospheric methane budgets. Nisbet led the MOIA project, focusing on global methane emissions using aircraft and ground-based field campaigns in Africa and South America. Born in Germany and raised in Africa, his fieldwork has taken him around the world. He is the author of the books The Young Earth and Leaving Eden to Protect and Manage the Earth. Ewan Nisbet, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
It's so nice to talk to you.
Yes. Actually, before we started recording, you were telling me about the origins of your name, and I'd like for you to go maybe back to your early years, your path to becoming an Earth System scientist.
I'm afraid, a terribly messy, complicated background. My father's family were Scottish and Canadian, and from background partly in farming, partly in actually making salt, cooking up seawater and making salt. Mother's family, African for many, many years, and I'm actually descended directly from Crateau, who was the first in Khoikhoi interpreter who met the Dutch settlers in Cape Town. She was also, I think, the first prisoner on Robben Island, which is where Nelson Mandela was later imprisoned. And she was my many greats grandmother. So, and my mother's family were, my great grandfather was the chief conservator for Southern Africa. They were conservationists. They were also road builders and geologists way back over the last couple of hundred years. And I was very lucky because I met my great-grandmother, who must have been born about 1860. And also, of course, my grandfather, he went blind when he was about 5 years old. And he was sent over from Africa to Oxford and became Oxford's first blind student. And he was a Christian minister, but also very, very deeply concerned about conservation. So part of my childhood was in a cloud forest in Southern Africa.
It's in your DNA and this longevity as well.
I don't know about the longevity, but I've got several hundred year olds. My parents met during the Second World War. My father had been very involved in Europe before the war. He was a Christian minister. And after the war, he was put in charge of the German church in the Commonwealth zone of northern Germany. So I was actually born in Germany, and I lived my first few years, and my father was in the president's office of the new German Republic. And so the people around me were the people creating the new West Germany. And then eventually Dad said, "This is ridiculous, having somebody Scottish here." And we went home to Africa. So I spoke German as much as English as my first language. So when I was five, I'd been back to Africa as visits earlier on ships. But when I was five, we moved finally back to Africa. But I then lost an eye, and that actually changed things a lot too, because that sent me effectively down a fairly academic path. So I had a blind grandfather and I was half blind. So at least I didn't have to serve in the military or anything like that.
Oh, that's an astonishing history of events. So was there always within you this underlying interest in conservation and earth sciences?
It was very deeply in my family. And because we sort of lived on the edge of a cloud forest, you could see all these changes. Earth sciences, yes, my great-grandmother's father and grandfather were the two first geologists in Southern Africa. And so they mapped South Africa in the 1840s and 1850s. And I still have a copy of that map. So it's, a very, very deep training in geology. And so when I was very lucky because my father's income was quite low. I got a scholarship to Cambridge. And when I set off, just before I got on the boat in Cape Town, I came down from Zimbabwe. I grew up in Zimbabwe. Came down, and just before I got on the boat, my great aunt gave me a copy of all the letters of my several greats grandfather, including letters to Charles Darwin. These are just copies; she transcribed them all. And so I got to Cambridge, and they said, "Well, I was doing physics, chemistry, maths." They said, "Do one more subject." They said, "Biology." I said, "I don't want to cut up frogs." As an idiot, because it would have been DNA; it would have been real fun. And so then, I had an ancestor who was a geologist, so why not do geology? And I had these letters and, I'll do geology. It looked like fun. So I went into geology that way.
And you talk about, I imagine that as you're growing up in these different countries, you're receiving, of course, your Christian faith is part of embracing and honoring the beauty and wonder of the natural world. I imagine there's some folk wisdom that you're receiving from these different countries in Zimbabwe, how that might have influenced your thinking about the world.
Well, I was quite lucky. As a geologist, I was mapping hard rocks, walking up and down with a hammer. But as grad students, I actually played hockey for a little while and went overland down Africa and saw the whole of Africa from Alexandria in Egypt right down. And I'd obviously grown up in Africa. I knew what Africa was, but I could see it changing so fast. And that sort of embedded there. Many years later, I was in Canada. And by that stage, I was looking after a committee that dealt with Canada's natural hazards, earthquakes and volcanoes and so on. And we were reporting to Ottawa. It was a major national committee. I was the chair of it. Got asked to look at gas platforms in the Arctic, which were falling over because they were drilling into methane deposits. And simultaneously, I was mapping in forest and falling in beaver ponds and bubbles would come up. So I got very interested in what were these bubbles and what was this strange methane ice stuff called methane hydrate. And I had a major project looking at platinum and things like that, basically economic minerals. And I was extremely lucky. The Canadians gave me a couple of years. It was actually sponsored by the Governor General to go away and have a think. And they wanted me to come back with lots of ideas how to get lots of new platinum mines. And I went off and had to think and wandered around and realized that the environment is really, really, really serious problem. And it's changing very, very fast. And in particular, this particular gas methane was right at the center of those changes. And at that stage, it's the 1980s, hardly anyone knew anything about methane. Where's it come from? What's it doing? Why is it going up? We hadn't a clue. And in those days, it was mostly gas industry. Methane is natural gas, and also the coal industry. But then we started looking at all the natural systems. Oh, well, they're doing things too. What's happening? And then there are all these cows. And it comes out the front end of the cow. If you want to be posh, it's called bovine eructation. That's the belch and the breath of a cow. Manure also makes it, and particularly if it's in a swimming pool of poo, which these industrial dairies have. When I was a child, it would come plop out in the field in Africa, and you could use it as a frisbee. That doesn't make much methane. But if it's in a swimming pool of manure, which is what we work on now, then it makes a lot of methane. So methane's a very interesting gas.
It's invisible and odorless. You were talking about how you fear it's becoming runaway. Help us understand how methane in the atmosphere, reducing methane in the atmosphere could help us stay. Well, I don't know if we can stay below 1.5% because we've already been told we've surpassed that.
Yeah, well, we'll back off a bit because methane has been made very, very much probably since almost the beginning of life. And early on, it was probably very important in keeping this planet habitable so that the seas didn't freeze up. Long ago, the sun was much fainter. It's only 3/4 or 80% of the brightness of today, and the planet would have frozen. And clearly, for long periods, life made methane. If we didn't have natural methane, natural CO2 in the atmosphere, the temperature would be 30-some centigrade cooler than it is today. We'd be frozen. So the natural greenhouse is really, really important. And of the two major greenhouse gases, CO2 is the one everyone thinks about, and that's around for a long time. Methane has a shorter lifetime, different ways of defining it, but it's about a decade. And it's actually destroyed by reactions in the atmosphere. And it's made by swamps, and a cow is just a walking swamp, but it's also made by wetlands. It's also made in fires. And then it's natural gas mostly. The smell of natural gas is actually introduced, so you can smell it. You can't smell methane itself. And what's been happening what happened in the 1980s was methane was rising very fast in the air. And that was largely leaks from the gas industry and to some extent from the coal industry as well. Plus, of course, more cows and all sorts of things like that. But as we introduce more cows, we wipe out lots of wild animals and they make methane too. And then methane stabilized in late 1990s and early 2000s. And then it took off again, but this time it's taken off in a very different way. And we think that largely the recent rise has been driven by warming wetlands, especially in the tropics, but also in Canada and the Russian Arctic, Siberia. And as you warm up the planet, although some areas get drier, a warmer world is actually a wetter world. You evaporate more water and more water falls. So it's going to rain like crazy in places like Uganda or Kenya, which is what it's doing right now. And then these wetlands spread. And if the wetlands are hotter, they also make more methane. And you can tell that by a rather clever trick. The different types of carbon, most of the carbon in us, and you know, we're carbon, is something called carbon 12. That's normal carbon. But about 1% of carbon is carbon 13. That's also perfectly ordinary natural carbon. There's also, you probably know about carbon 14 that the archaeologists use for dating. That's made up at the top of the atmosphere, and that's radioactive. But carbon 13 it's normal, it's about 1% of normal carbon. But the ratio of 12 to 13 varies depending on who made the methane. So if it's a wetland or a cow, there's a lot of 12. But if the methane comes from a gas field or a fire or a coal mine, it tends to be a little bit richer than the 13. And so during the 200 years, as humans started burning fossil fuels, the methane in the air got a bit richer in carbon 13. But since 2007, it's been getting richer and quite quickly richer in carbon 12. That tells you it's biological sources. And a lot of that growth has been happening in the tropics, not all of it. And that suggests that it's tropical wetlands initially, also probably nowadays northern wetlands as well, plus, of course, cows. And it's the biology is doing this, but it looks like an Earth feedback. We warm up the planet, and the Earth gives off more methane then and warms us up more. And that's feedback. You push it one way, and then something pushes it even further. And that's actually probably the biggest challenge to the Paris Agreement hopes now.
Yes. How does this work within that equation that wetlands are the most effective carbon sink?
So it depends on your time scale. If you're talking of millions or thousands of years or so, a coal mine is essentially a squash wetland. Yeah, it's a good carbon sink. But if you're talking on the next 50 to 100 years, then it's a trade-off because the wetlands and the peatlands are busy sucking down carbon and laying down lots of carbon. Trees do the same. But if they're making methane, then they're pumping in this very strong greenhouse gas into the air. And as a greenhouse gas, weight for weight or molecule for molecule, methane is much stronger than CO2. Even though it's only got this decadal lifetime, what global warming is about is essentially warming up the oceans. If you warm up the top of the oceans, if there's heat in there, then your climate's going to shift. And that's really what global warming is about. And so if the methane means more heat gets into the oceans, then we warm up. And yeah, in 200 years' time, that methane's gone, but you still got the heat. So that's the problem. You're balancing one thing against another. I loved beavers when I was mapping, and I did lots of mapping in northern Canada, and you see these wonderful animals. Now, beaver's a classic example. It cuts down a tree. It drags the tree into a pond. It's made the pond by damming it up. It sequesters, eventually, the carbon goes into the ooze. But they're also monster methane factories. And all that vegetation just rots. And methane is made by anaerobic decay, in anaerobic decays. So the oxygen is used up. And then methanogenic microbes, they're called archaea, they make the methane. And beavers, of course, make the ponds that produce this anaerobic habitat. And then they fill it full of organic matter. And you get a lot of methane. So beavers do it both ways. They sequester carbon, but they also make lots of methane. So it's a timescale issue. So yeah, wetlands are fantastic over hundreds of thousands of years. But over the next 10 years, I'm not suggesting we should drain all the wetlands, far from it. What we can do, about very roughly 60% of the methane in the air is made by human sources directly. And about 40% is natural from wetlands and natural animals and so on. Now, that 40% is probably rising. Human sources, the most obvious ones are gas leaks, coal mine vents, fires, waste fires, landfills, manure pools, all that sort of thing. Those we can control. And so if the natural sources are rising fast, then the obvious thing to do, the most obvious one, is stop gas leaks. And we can see the big gas leaks for satellites now. And I think we're beginning to do a pretty good job on that. It's only just beginning. But fortunately, the gas companies, of course, a gas leak is a waste of money anyway. Next big one would be...
Mm-hmm. Oh, and how does that work politically? Because I know, like with Russia now and...
Yeah, that's another problem. In most of the world, except Russia and Iran, to some extent, some of the Stan countries, but they're changing, have not signed up to this. But equally, when they see a big gas leak on a satellite, that's money. You want to put the gas into a pipeline. You don't want to leak it out. So I think things are happening there. The other problem is with coal mines, and coal mines are full of methane. And so you have to vent them so they don't explode on you. And so coal mine vents are very rich in methane. And China recently has brought in the Chinese national methane policy. So although China hasn't signed the global agreement called the Global Methane Pledge, it is saying it's going to do something. India, however, has not. In the Global Methane Pledge was the agreement to cut methane emissions by 30% by the end of the decade. And the big standouts really are the world's biggest producer, China, but they've decided they may be going to do something. And then Russia and India. The other of the top four is the United States is trying very hard. And then, of course, there's Iran as well, which has also not signed. So all of this is really quite feasible to do things about. The other things are things like landfills. Now, in Europe, the Europeans have been very effective in reducing emissions from landfills. And landfills, they produce more than 10% of the world's methane emissions. And for example, in the United Kingdom, they've been very, very effective in reducing the emissions. At the crudest, you just put a meter of soil on top and bacteria called methanotrophs, they actually eat the methane. Methane's food, so it stops leaks. So all you need to do is bulldoze soil properly, actually. You can manage it by putting pipes and take out the methane and use it to make electricity, which is what they do in Europe. But India in particular has these enormous landfills, which are very, very poorly managed and often bursting into fire as well. And it's also huge amounts of air pollution come from it. And what's also happening in both India and widely across Africa is burning crop waste. For example, if you grow a maize plant, you harvest the maize, the corn on the cob, but what do you do with the plant? Well, one thing is to give it to cattle, but a lot of it just gets burnt. And in Africa, there's enormous amounts of fires and burning, terrible air pollution. India also has extreme air pollution, and I don't know how they can tolerate it. And a lot of that comes from crop waste fires. And that, it makes carbon monoxide and air pollution, but it also makes methane. So these things are fairly readily addressable, the gas leaks, the coal mine vents, the landfills, and the crop waste fires. All of these, they're good other reasons to do things about them.
So if I understand, because I didn't realize that about the landfills, that solution. So that's not exactly composting. This is just covering with soil?
Well, in most landfills in Europe and to some extent in the United States and Canada are actually extremely highly instrumented nowadays. And yes, you put a plastic cover over it and then you put a soil cover on that. They're lovely. They're full of butterflies and things nowadays. They don't smell. But you also put a lot of pipes down them and you pipe out the methane and then you burn that methane and make electricity. And so that means instead of burning natural gas, you're actually making your electricity from whatever your rubbish is. Now, nowadays in Europe, we collect a lot of our kitchen food waste and so on and send that off to biodigesters, where they turn that into gas and sometimes into other fuels as well. The problem is that those biodigesters in Europe are often very leaky, and they leak a lot of methane, and they shouldn't. So they're putting gas into the system or making electricity, or sometimes you can turn it into tractor fuels. And lots of farms have biodigesters as well. So the stuff you collect in your green bin, and I don't know what they do in Paris, but certainly all over Europe, you basically turn that into some sort of product, very likely just methane gas. You can even turn it into aviation fuel. And that's going on very widely. But unfortunately, a lot of these plants are pretty leaky. As a very rough rule, if you drive past it and you can smell it, it's probably emitting methane as well. The smell is something else, but
if you solve that,
better engineering. Oh, it's quite soluble. Good management, good engineering. Just make sure that the joints leak and the stuff doesn't go out. Often it's deliberately vented. Yeah, you know, it's a nuisance and it's just vented.
I feel guilty because I always felt I was doing well by composting, but I'm not doing.
You are. It's just that you've got to make sure it down the track that they do the right thing as well.
Yes. So tell us about your work. It's Moya, sorry.
Moya. Okay. Moya, an African word. My mother spoke Xhosa and actually many Southern African dialects. It means air, but it also means breath and it means spirit. And in the South African National Anthem, it essentially means Holy Spirit. And the British Research Council were wonderful. They gave us £5 million, which is plus some other monies as well, to try to put together coordinated program to look at the global methane budget. So we were looking at methane emissions and things like landfills in Britain as well. But we used the British research aircraft and we flew that down over wetlands in Africa and also over fires. So we started off flying over fires in Senegal, which was quite dramatic. You're flying at a couple of hundred meters and suddenly, doink, the biggest bump in the pilot's lifetime experience. And he was a very experienced pilot. Very dramatic fires and a lot of methane coming off there. So we were trying to track those, see what fires are doing. And then I sent the plane down to Uganda and the Ugandan government were helpful, let us fly around Uganda. And then the Zambian government were extremely helpful because the Upper Congo wetlands have hardly ever been studied. And the Congo, the Democratic Republic, people don't like flying there, it's too dangerous. But you can fly over the Upper Congo in Zambia. And we flew over a huge wetland called Banguiulu. Banguiulu is pretty interesting. It's a major Upper Congo sort of seep area that eventually feeds the Upper Congo. There's a big lake there, but not much methane comes off the lakes. But the wetlands are just pouring the stuff off. And they make about as much methane as Britain, which is pretty big. It's also interesting because that's where David Livingstone died. He was trying to stop the slave trade. And it's, curiously, it's where the First World War ended. The German army was attacking Lusaka. And the Brits came along to them and said, excuse me, but you've stopped fighting in Europe. It's now November 1918. Can you sort of stop fighting? They stopped. And the end of the First World War was in Zambia, very close to Lake Banguiulu.
I never realized that.
It means where the water meets the sky. And that's exactly what the place is. So we also flew, we kidnapped the British Antarctic Survey's, one of their planes, because it had to fly back from Antarctica to Canada for service. And with a lot of help from the university in La Paz, flew it over wetlands, Amazonian wetlands in northern Bolivia, and saw these enormous methane emissions from the Bolivian wetlands. So they're doing the same thing as the Zambian wetlands over in Africa. It was fascinating work. But Moya did lots of other things. Some friends of ours in Edinburgh set up a station in Lake Okavango, in the Okavango wetlands, which is actually probably where modern human beings came from originally. I told you a while ago, my distant ancestors were Khoi people in Cape Town, and some of them probably came from Okavango. The rest of us human beings went across, up through Africa and across Asia and Europe and Australasia and the Americas eventually in other directions. So Okavango is pretty important. It may be where the first modern humans, that's our type of humans, originally started. So it was a very diverse project. We also did work in Canada and in Finland looking at Arctic wetlands. And I think we learned quite a lot about the methane budget, but there's still huge problems. We still don't know why it's responding so fast. And the big fear is that what's going on at the moment looks very similar to what has repeatedly happened at the end of ice ages. You get a long ice age, and then suddenly the world warms up. So the total warming process to get rid of the ice takes thousands of years. But in the middle of that, there's something called the abrupt phase. So the ice sort of starts warming and then does that, and then it ends all. In the abrupt phase, the planet's climate changes in a few decades, and the methane goes crazy in that period. And that's exactly, it looks so similar. So that worries us. We don't know, but these are known scientifically as termination events, the terminations of the ice cores, of the ice ages. And there's a whole string of them. They've got Roman numbers, 9, 8, 5, but all in numbers, sort of. And the last great termination event, it was sort of multi-stage, but the end of it was over 11,000 years ago. You can track it in ice cores, down to the almost exact years. Very, very quick changes. And it looks very much as if we're in that type of change, that the world's climate system doesn't move smoothly. Goes along like that, and then suddenly it's bistable. Obviously, ice age to interglacial, that's done repeatedly. Where we're going is from interglacial to something else. If you look in the long perspective of history, we're sort of in an ice age. We've got Antarctica under ice. We've got Greenland under ice. And the next step is get rid of that ice.
Well, you can't, it's extremely nonlinear and you can't get it back. And then on the other hand, I'm trying to balance my mind around this. There's also the possibility that with the Earth system's collapse, that we could have cooling in Europe.
Yeah, and yes and no. One of the characteristics of these termination events is that the oceanic overturning circulation changes. And there's several big systems here. One is what's called the Atlantic overturning, where water comes up in the Gulf Stream, it gets up into the poles. By that stage, it's very cold and salty. It falls down and it goes down the Atlantic, rounds the top of Antarctica, meets up with the Antarctic bottom water, and then eventually comes up in the Pacific and then comes back on the top. And that circulation changes. It slows during the ice ages. And so if you get a lot of fresh water into the Pacific, the high Arctic, that circulation will slow. And there's quite a lot of evidence that circulation is slowing. In some ways, it's beneficial to Britain because it means the whole world is warming. But for the UK, the warming's a bit less because there's less heat being delivered upwards. There's also something called the Indian Ocean Dipole. Now, you've probably heard of El Nino, and we're just coming out of an El Nino phase, which essentially exports heat from the ocean at the top, which accumulates in the La Nina period, and then exports it and shoves it around the world. And then you go back to the La Nina. The Indian Ocean Dipole is a similar sort of thing in the Indian Ocean, and that's responsible for lots of rain in Central Africa. So when that shifts, you can get very big climate changes as well. And these things happen in the termination events, and it looks like they're happening at the moment. But weather is weather. It's hard to tell when weather becomes climate. You don't know.
Yes. And so, okay, so you outlined termination event. I know that's technically the term. You're not trying to be bleak. What are some solutions that you haven't mentioned yet in terms of agriculture? And yes,
there are all sorts of solutions. Now, first of all, I've got a sort of philosophical view. A British politician once said, when you're in a hole, stop digging. Or in American politics, the cover-up is always worse than the crime. In other words, stop emitting the stuff. And particularly with methane, that's relatively easy. With CO2, it's more complicated because we've got to change all of our transport and all of our heating and so on. But with methane, there's some fairly quick things that we are doing, but we need to do them a lot faster. There are many people saying we should, for example, store CO2, essentially large-scale technical solutions, all the way up to putting an alum foil mirror around the planet or something, or changing the atmosphere. I intrinsically, philosophically, I think those are pretty scary to me, that it's far better just to stop the damage. If you got $1 million to spend, where would I spend it? I'd spend it on stopping the damage rather than trying to do a cover-up. What will have to happen, because climate is clearly changing and it's changing fast, is fairly large-scale changes in agricultural management, in the way we design cities, and the way we provide water supplies. It looks like human population is attaining a peak, probably during this century, maybe around about 10 billion. Now, of course, what's been driving agriculture is the need for food. And I think in many countries, apart from the middle of Africa and the Middle East, the populations are already stabilizing and indeed intrinsically falling. So I suspect that over the next 50 years, our technical abilities are going to go up and we are going to be able to do a lot of good. Equally, we can do a huge amount of bad before we start. The good we're doing catches up with the bad we've been doing. And an awful lot of this is built in, that the climate we experience, which essentially depends on the temperature of the top of the oceans, is a result of all the carbon dioxide and the methane that we've put in. And that's going to keep on warming for quite a long time, even if we just stop our emissions tomorrow. So this is something that's going on. Even if we start behaving incredibly tomorrow morning, this is going to go on for centuries and centuries. Yeah. And we've so much changed the environment. As a student, when I walked over, I went overland over Africa, forest everywhere, all sorts of wonderful things. As a small child, I remember going on a train journey alone, and you look out of the, there was a sort of gap between the carriages where you could stand on a platform, and you could see giraffes as the train rattled along. Things like that. Don't see that now. It's all gone. The earth is a garden. It's not wild.
Have you seen, and I want to go back to your reflections on, you know, future cities, because you're talking about management and all those things, but did you witness the Great Migration or?
Yeah, well, humans do what humans are. We're, you know, it's our planet and we're free to mess it up as we choose. I'm African. I've actually been denied entry at Heathrow in the UK. I had a, what nowadays is called a Windrush passport. So I, you know, I've been stateless. I've known these problems and I know how difficult they are. I also know how complex it is in democracies. So not only do we have to arrange our own affairs, being cut up in various different countries and so on, with competing ideologies, but we simultaneously have to care for the planet and we have to realize what we're doing to the planet. And the more we mismanage it, the more difficult it becomes for everybody. So the constructive side of that is that it's a common challenge. And for example, when the American president meets the Chinese president, what's the thing they talk about when they met last year? It's the climate problem. And they had a common challenge, and that was the thing that brought them together. So although it's a very scary challenge, it is actually a challenge that brings humans together. We have to cooperate.
Indeed, it's a really interdisciplinary, and you mentioned there are cities and the changes that we can make. We're talking about a decade of transformation, and cities are the main drivers often for creativity and innovation, consuming, as you know, like 75% of the world's natural resources, accounting for, I think, if this is current, 70% of global carbon dioxide emissions, the other gas. So, you know, what do you think the cities of the future are going to look like in terms of energy, transport, resources?
I would hope very, very different. Many, many ways. Transport, obviously. Well, we're moving quite fast to electric transport, but I would hope that we live in ways where we don't have to move quite so much. I'm rather sad at my university, there are so many people working from home, so you don't actually meet them. And I think we lose something when we don't meet up. So going to work together and doing things communally is important. On the other hand, not doing all that commuting is probably also pretty important. A small but really irritating thing is in the UK, we're sticking solar panels all over the best farmland and then importing food from goodness knows where. And yet you drive past these miles of warehouses where all our online goods are stored and not a single one's got a solar panel on the roof. So that sort of fine detail behavior, I think we're very poor at. We could, I think, in the next few decades, generate most of our energy by a mix of wind and solar, a bit of nuclear and some good batteries. And I think that is coming, but I wish we would do that, particularly in our cities, that, and particularly in the industrial parts of our cities and the car parks. Food, though, you know, where's our food come from? And I think, particularly in Europe, where wind power in the nights, in the winter, actually often is negative price. My son-in-law charges up his electric car at 3 a.m. and is paid to do that many nights, because it's cheaper to pay somebody to take the electricity than to turn off the nuclear reactor or the wind power. And so that means that we can run greenhouses, for example, and grow our fruit and veg in Northern Europe rather than bringing it from intercontinentally at times. You know, quite a lot of our fruit and veg is flown from very long distances, make that local. So I think making particularly food production local, I think, is going to be important. I mentioned earlier on just how wonderful Venice is. Of course, Venice, yeah, it was beautiful. But of course, they were trading all over the world. So they actually had huge imports from all around the world. But somehow they did it. Whereas if you walk around Cambridge and you see these monster new fortress-like, it looks like something that's come out of East Germany. Buildings, I've been told off strongly by a friend of mine who lives in one, so they're very comfy. But in design terms, I think we need to think much, much harder. We wrap sustainable labels around absolutely everything, but what does it mean? And I think quite a lot of our city living is important. Used to live in a late Victorian terraced house, maybe it was even Edwardian, and the British terraced houses, everyone had their little long strip of garden. And that was incredibly important. It was only about 4 or 5 meters wide and about 20 meters long. It gave you the garden. So, and those British terraced houses, for living, they're just incredibly nice ways to live. Nowadays, I've got a separate house with a separate garden, which I think is pretty important. But I think living that way is important, that you do have some patch of garden where you can grow your own beans.
Exactly. We need to decarbonize so much as well. And you're talking about the building industry and all this. You'd also mentioned education, and that's a landscape that's changing. I wonder what your reflections are on the future of education and how you see how we adapting our education models to better prepare students for the challenges like climate change and for the future of work, which is so uncertain.
Well, in a strange way, I was very lucky because I got an education in Cambridge in the late 60s that was really very diverse. Nowadays, certainly in our science courses, we're actually de-skilling people a lot. We have a lot more people in university, but they're learning less. An awful lot of them are doing business studies. Goodness knows what they learn. I'm sure business studies is great stuff, but when you actually talk to them, they know so little about the world. And the sorts of things that we learned about the world back in the 60s, we're not given. Also, we learnt an awful lot about, by various means, the humanities that nowadays the education, certainly in the UK, but I think it's not just the UK, there's far more product, but there's far less quality. The intensity of the education is less. That's an opinion and it's biased, and I'm saying it anecdotally without deep evidence. But certainly in right across the earth sciences in Britain, and I think it's in Europe too, the detail that the students used to know, the factual detail, is much less now. They have far less practical experience, far less boots on the ground. We used to go for long, long field trips. You don't get that now. The field trips are much shorter. The actual practical experience is far less. So I'm rather sad that education, yes, it's widened, but it's also essentially become less quality in it. That's an inevitable trade-off, but because so many people are doing subjects like business studies, which are skills that might not last very long.
It's interesting because I think that many might be drawn to that because they think it's viable. Yeah.
My son told me a fascinating story. He's probably forgotten this. He did physics at a very reputable place. And he was exaggerating, but he said these were sort of finally his students as they walked out of their physics labs. They used to get waylaid by recruiters offering them a brand new fancy car and all the rest of it. And these were people recruiting for the finance industry and for oil trading. And so all the best and the brightest of the physics grads were being carted off and going off and trading on the market. Yeah, okay, they make lots of money. But do you lose your physics skill at the same time? And I think there's been quite a lot of that going on. But it's also true in the humanities, the depths of knowledge of things like classics. I think that intellectual training was very important. There's far less of it now. Sorry, I'm digressing.
It's interesting. You know, with the advent of AI, which is we are outsourcing so much to that. And I understand there are benefits as you're talking about being able to detect. I think it has applications for being able to detect methane leaks. But we're outsourcing so much of our imagination and creativity and just so much else. And so it's making us lazy.
Yeah, as I think you mentioned, I am a Christian and I have strong Muslim friends and strong Jewish friends and also great respect for Hindu links as well. So very strong links. And I grew up in Southern Africa, where I was well aware of the depth of some of the indigenous beliefs. And I think that having belief systems does give you a very, very different perspective sometimes. Now, in Christianity, the concept of the shepherd, that, yeah, human beings are here, and yeah, this is our garden, this is our Garden of Eden, but we have responsibility. And if we choose to kick ourselves out of the garden, well, there are consequences. And that's precisely what we are doing. The garden is there, it's lovely, and we can manage it. And it's our job to manage it. We can manage it properly. We can respect it. It's for all creation. And it's very explicit that it involves all creation. And that's a very fundamental biblical law, that you have to respect all creation. And if you don't do that, then there are consequences. You're basically throwing yourself out of the Garden of Eden. That's very important in my views on the environment, actually.
Indeed. I think that it's an a more education in moral philosophy, again, is something that's also been eliminated from many of our educational models. And I think that people many who don't have a faith or don't, maybe sometimes it's wedded to the arts, sometimes it's less, it's more secular, but it's a, how do you say, it's connecting you with a cultural memory, it's connecting with previous generations so that you don't believe it's just the whole world is oriented around you, because this is the extractivist thinking, which is so dangerous now.
I'm actually a member of Darwin College in Cambridge, and Charles Darwin's one of my heroes. And Darwin was agnostic, wasn't atheist. And he asked these questions, you know, we really don't know the answers why we're here. We haven't a clue. My training was in physics. And the moment you get into quantum physics, you enter something that is highly mystical. It's the universe is something way, way, way beyond our understanding. A very long way. We haven't a clue. And anyone who says that they know the answer is a complete fool. So both being an atheist or being somebody who believes in something, either way, yeah, you can't prove it. And St. Paul, in his speech in Athens, he quotes Epimenides, that all Cretans are liars. If you turn that in mass, that's called Gödel's principle, that some propositions are true, but by their very nature, you can't prove them. So Epimenides is a Cretan, and he's saying all Cretans are liars. Is he telling the truth or is he not? You don't know. You can't. And in maths and physics, some propositions are true, and you simply by their nature, if God gives you freedom, cannot prove God exists, because that means there's freedom to deny one side or the other. So if there's freedom, then there can't be proof. You can't see in the universe a proof, because you've got freedom to say no. That's the complexity of Epimenides. And as a scientist, you don't know, but you do see in the creation this incredible beauty and complexity and challenge. And actually, the environmental challenge, I think, is one of the great things bringing humans together. It's a very tough challenge. It may destroy us. Well, destroy is the wrong word. You know, whatever happens to the climate, there are going to be humans scrabbling around doing something in the dust. But it could make life very difficult, and it's very likely that states will fail to some extent. You could say Somalia, for example, failed because of major climate change. That type of impact is going to happen.
As you think about the future, the teachers who were important to you, who inspired you on your path, the importance of the humanities and the sciences, scientists, what you've learned along the way, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
To know, preserve, and remember? That's an almost impossible question, because their sight of the world is going to be so different from mine. Yeah, I grew up in a post-Second World War world. I saw the ruins of Germany when I was a small child, broken cities, broken bridges across the Rhine and so on. And I saw how things got so much better. And then I saw perhaps the last of wild Africa. I mapped in southern Zimbabwe, in bushland. I saw wonderful, wonderful things. And I've seen that go. So nowadays, wild Africa is confined to national parks, essentially. It's not all over the place. I've seen these changes. So I do hope that the next generation will cherish what's left and then think about rebuilding. And I think that will happen, I hope. I hope that as education improves globally, there'll be the sense that we can do things. And as communication improves as well, we'll be able to see views from other places. There's obviously tremendous concern about the environment. And what scares me is a lot of people are frightened and fearful and saying, no, they're not going to have any children or anything like that. And basically, that's just giving up. It's an immensely difficult problem, but it's also an immensely creative problem, because we can find ways through it. And those ways will be collaborative. They'll bring us together. I hope they will also be rooted in concepts of value and worth. Why are we doing this? Which takes you back to intellectual thoughts and, well, concepts of religion too. Why is this precious? Should we be sharing? Should we be respecting the natural world? In some ways, it's interesting that these feedbacks from the natural world in the methane budget were unexpected. We basically trashed the natural world, so it's hitting back. Yeah, we need to respect it. I'm very hopeful, but quite scared at the same time.
Well, very important words. Thank you, Ewan Nisbet, for sharing your appreciation of the beauty and wonder of the natural world and for inspiring us with your spirit of collaboration and vision of possible futures. And just your research that help us understand Earth systems, where we are on climate, and providing scientific knowledge so that we might meet our goals and avoid the worst of climate change impacts. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and The Creative Process.
Okay, thanks, man. Just incredibly nice to talk to you.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Sophie Garnier. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.